and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is Sidney Lumet, one of the most successful directors in Hollywood history. Lumet began his career as a child actor in the 1930s, working alongside his father as part of the Yiddish Theater. At age 15, he co-starred alongside Sylvia Sidney in the drama One Third a Nation. Used as a bargaining chip by the studio against fellow child star Freddie Bartholomew, young Sidney was summarily let go by the studio once they got Bartholomew back under contract. Abandoning film acting, a few years later, Lumet enlisted and served in World War II. Once he returned to the States, he fell into directing in the new medium known as television, quickly showing a facility for knowing how to tell a story visually and work with actors, giving them the space and freedom to deliver their best performances. Then, in 1957, when Henry Fonda needed a director for a film he was producing, a mutual friend introduced them, and Lumet made his feature film debut with 12 Angry Men. An instant classic, 12 Angry Men was nominated for 3 Oscars, including Best Picture, showing all that Lumet had learned in television. Despite all this, the film was a financial disappointment, which forced Lumet back to television while trying to find his footing in feature films. After working with Fonda again in 1958's Stagestruck and Marlon Brando in 1960's The Fugitive Kind, Lumet took a creative gamble with 1962's Long Day's Journey Into Night, which starred Katharine Hepburn, Ralph Richardson, Jason Robards, and Dean Stockwell as the tortured Tyrone family. Almost 3 hours long and mimicking the structure of the play, Lumet and his cast took minimal salaries to help get the film financed. At this point, Lumet never looked back, becoming one of the most prolific directors of his time, delivering a film a year for almost 2 decades. He helmed the Holocaust drama The Pawnbroker, the nuclear war thriller Failsafe, again with Henry Fonda, the war drama The Hill, the literary adaptation The Group, and the heist film The Anderson Tapes, his second of 5 collaborations with Sean Connery. As good as his 1960s output was, Lumet had an even better run in the 1970s. Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, my personal favorite, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, and Prince of the City. In between all of those, he managed to direct Equus and the musical The Wiz. Just as prolific in the 80s, Lumet struggled a little to connect with audiences the way he did in the 70s, still managing to produce some great films like 1982's The Verdict starring Paul Newman, 1983's Daniel with Timothy Hutton, and 1986's Running on Empty with River Phoenix. Slowing down a bit in the 1990s, like he did in the 80s, he still produced interesting, diverse work like the underrated 1997 comedy Critical Care and 2006's Find Me Guilty, where he managed to coax a charming comedic performance from Vin Diesel. He teamed with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ethan Hawke, Marissa Tomei, and Albert Finney for his final film, 2007's Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Speaking of coaxing performances from recalcitrant actors, join me to discuss Before the Devil Knows You're Dead and the career of Sidney Lumet is the director of 1979's Rock and Roll High School, Get Crazy, and Heartbeats, the legendary Alan Arkush. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, when it came up and I got the offer and we talked about Sidney Lumet, it struck a chord with me. Because of my age, I saw so many of his movies as they came out. So certainly his tremendous output of the 70s and 80s, I saw in theaters the week it came out or the 2 weeks after that. Then doing some research and some odd things, I found out about his background in Yiddish theater, which rang for me because my grandfather was a fan of Yiddish theater, mm-hmm. and the theaters that Mr. Lumet worked in were in the East Village on 2nd Avenue. And I lived in high school at 2nd Avenue and 10th Street. And the Fillmore East, where I worked, which was the greatest rock and roll theater, was originally a Yiddish theater.
Wow.
And that's why it was outfitted so completely for theatrical productions. So that was all something I knew about. A little personal thing, as much as I liked his movies, I was having dinner with my father in New York City. And he goes, oh, my God, there's Sidney Lumet. He says, Sid Lumet. And I go, oh, yeah, I see him. And he says, let's go say hello. And I said, why? And he goes, didn't you know he and I went to Zionist youth camp together? The same Zionist youth camp, Camp Kindervelt, okay. That I had gone to. And it was a moment I will always regret. I panicked and said, no, no, no. And I actually never got to meet him.
Oh, no.
Yes, it was stupid, but I wish I had, you know.
Oh.
And, you know, just thinking about him, whatever it is that your first exposure to Lumet's films are, it always ends up being about 12 Angry Men. Whether it is the first one or not, and if you're in a certain age group, the impression you get from that film is so strong that it feels like every other movie he's made lines up behind him, mm-hmm. behind that one. It's like, here is my statement. I can do this in one room. You know, I can do a thing where each character is so vivid. I can do this with characters you hate and a character that is so reasoning, it drives you mad. And it's just a great work.
I remember the first time I saw the movie, I was working at a video store and I had never seen it, familiar with it, but I'd never seen it. And I brought it home and I was staying up all night at those days, working the video store in the day and sleep, you know, taking home five movies at night and just barreling through them. And I remember laying on the couch and I got so wrapped up in the story that I leapt off the couch and was leaning literally on the edge of the sofa, yelling at the television because I was so wrapped up in Lee J. Cobb and Ed Begley. And I was like, no, come on. And then, you know, the whole thing, and it's like 93 minutes too. I mean, it's just like, it's such a complete work. And I want to ask you this. Like, I think for me, that was the first time I paid attention to who directed this. And then I went back and I saw, oh, Sidney Lumet. And I was like, oh, I'd already seen Dog Day Afternoon. I'd already seen that one at that point. Do you remember when you were cognizant of who this guy is and this is the kind of movies he makes?
Well, yes. And later on, because I've done 90% of my work has been on television dramas. And I know he had an extensive career. When I look at all his television drama credits, I've seen some of them, you know, especially the ones that were on networks. So I've always felt an affinity for him. And I think the one that registered first the most was The Pawnbroker. Because I think I saw that around the time it came out. That was the one, and I saw it in New York, right near the East Village, and it was coming from a background where I have a lot of Holocaust survivors in my family. It really, really struck a tone, and its audacity visually is tremendous. And it's one of the ones I watched this week. I just rewatched it yesterday, and it is his most expressionistic work. Mm. He doesn't usually step out that far in style. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very stylish, but he's so good at tying it to narrative that you're involved in the story and the acting. But we'll get to the editing in a second, but those shots of him, that night from hell of the pawnbroker walking through New York City, I was taken by the fact that it stood apart from a lot of the rest of Lumet's films and that it was extremely expressionistic and that his expressionistic effects stood out. And that's not something you find in his other work. It's not to say that he doesn't have style because he's constantly thinks about style, but is always in terms of narrative. And because you had a man like the pawnbroker at the edge of his sanity, he presented him in a city that was very stylized in the way it was photographed by Boris Kaufman. And he takes a long walk at night through the city. And on the screen for only about one held film from the back of a vehicle. So it was truly bouncing. It was much clearer, more obvious in effect than Lumet normally does. And also, that doesn't even begin to talk about the way it's edited. Now, I had read Ralph Rosenblum's book, When the Shooting Stops. And Ralph Rosenblum was a great editor. He edited probably Woody Allen's first five or six movies. And he also edited The Pawnbroker and The Producers and just a really terrific editor. And right at that point, in the early 60s, editing went from being hot on a slideshow, and you have to scrape away the emulsion on one of them and glue them together. And when you do that, you lose one frame. So you always make your choice to edit by adding one frame that'll go away.
Okay.
Now, if you want to change your mind about a cut, you have to reprint both shots by the type of energy found in 60s movies. And the music found in 60s movies is brought a huge revolution in how movies were edited. All you have to do, as you know, as a film historian, look at the early 60s British films. Hard Day's Night, Tom Jones, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. And then you keep going, and the editing became obvious. And Ralph Rosenblum took the job of the editor and used it to shape and change material in big ways. If you look at 1,000 Clowns, he really changed that movie, and it completely changed Take the Money and the Run. Mm. And he started experimenting on The Pawnbroker with 3-frame cuts, those quick cuts and everything. And he actually, with Lumet together, they came up with some ideas of how to make the past in the present in a contemporary way. And that's why there's all those flashbacks that happen so fast,
right,
that you don't really see them. And they return to the same shot. The most bravura part of that is when he's on the subway and it turns into a car to Auschwitz.
Right.
And so that was very, very bold. And I know, seeing it again, I thought, I got to show a clip from this to my AFI student. So that was one that I remember seeing early on. You know, I saw Failsafe in 16 millimeter. I'm very close friends with Joe Dante. Mm-hmm. And Joe is a big film collector, and he had a print of Failsafe. So we used to watch Failsafe and another movie, Advise and Consent, I think, or The Best Man.
I love Advise and Consent. I love that movie.
It's another where Henry Fonda becomes president. So it would be our Henry Fonda is actually our president, double bill. Anderson Tapes, I definitely saw in a theater in London. And I thought, this is a damn good cop movie thriller, you know. So it was by that point that I was becoming aware of Lumet. And I think I seen the group when it came out. But then he got into his run in the 70s. And that is almost without equal,
mm-hmm,
in terms of what he achieved, you know. How much you want to break down these movies, or how?
Oh, I mean, let's get into it as much as we want to. I mean, he certainly is. One of the things that I was amazed about him, and we kind of covered this 2 episodes ago when I did a show on William Wyler, was that, like, it's not somebody who you don't think, when you think of, like, you know, Orson Welles, you could think of memorable shots of Orson Welles, or of course Alfred Hitchcock, or any of the real, you know, but like, there aren't that many shots that you, other than what you were, again, you're just talking about, like, there aren't like Lumet shots exactly. And yet, obviously, he had a very particular point of view because he had this amazing filmography over 40 years, you know?
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, okay. All right? You're not getting the whole picture here. There is no corporate countries. There is only IBM, that scene, but that one. As soon as you see that room and you see those lamps, mm-hmm, lined up in a row, he delivers one of the most memorable shot sequences.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I'm just being devil's advocate here.
Right.
On the other hand, another tremendously memorable shot he did is in The Verdict, when Paul Newman gives his summation, and it starts as a wide shot of the courtroom, and very, very slowly.
Oh, right. It's way high up in the rafters, and then comes down.
Slowly. And in The Devil Knows You're Dead, there is a slow push in on a very, very important monologue from
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
in the sex worker's apartment, and it gets closer and closer to him, and Seymour Hoffman ends up pretty far camera right. And in the background, you still see the sex worker, but because of the focal length, he has become soft in the frame, and your attention is all on Seymour Hoffman. So he chooses carefully, and I think that he puts himself in positions where the style is there. For example, Prince of the City. The opening, and I don't remember, really is the opening. At night, there's a chase going on with the cops in a burnt out set of buildings in the rain. And I had worked with Andrei Barkosiak about, and so I asked him about that. Oh, and wow. he says, that sequence has made my life a nightmare. And I said, why? He says, because everyone wants me to do it. And they always say, oh, go ahead and do it. I mean, you didn't use hardly any lights. And it'll be so cheap. I said, hardly any lights. I lit like six blocks. We had to have an exposure at night in the rain with all those buildings lit. Now, that's a pretty audacious approach. And so the style was Lumet taking his cop and putting him in a vast wasteland. It's a visual metaphor. And in going through Making Movies again, his book, which is really great reading.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. People remember the stuff about the actors, but the stuff about his visuals, he usually starts rehearsing, and he'll rehearse on a stage for a week, taping off each room. And he says it's during that rehearsal that he's not only working on honing in on the characters, but he is also honing in on the visual style. And, you know, he's already scouted the location, so he's a pretty good idea of what it's going to look like. And he's certainly a gifted enough filmmaker to know where to put the camera in any place. So what he does is he starts saying what the visual effect should be. You know, what lenses should I be? Should I change the lensing? And he does this quite a bit. Change the lensing throughout the picture for a different effect, you know. And so there is quite a bit of style. And I think for me in the 70s, when he started to make movies that were getting a lot of attention, I'm pretty sure I saw Serpico on Hollywood Boulevard and Murder on the Orient Express. There was a thing that was going on in Los Angeles, okay? I lived five blocks from Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles. And Hollywood Boulevard at that time was where the grindhouses were, the beloved grindhouses of Quentin Tarantino's youth and the equivalent of 42nd Street. So what you saw there was the movies that I was actually cutting trailers for, the Roger Corman movies would play up there. And some first run movies actually at the Big Chinese or the Egyptian, but there were many, many other movie houses. So the Egyptian and the Chinese played the A pictures from the big studios, and the other stuff was lesser. So if you wanted to see a Lumet movie, you went to Westwood on a weekend. And in Westwood is where you saw all the classy UA movies, you know, that were coming out, all the Woody Allen movies, and you saw a different kind of group of people, you know, going to the movie. And so that's where I went, and I saw Dog Day Afternoon. And I must say, Dog Day Afternoon's effect on me, watching it and coming out of it, really knocked me for a loop. I think it's a great movie. And I think my appreciation for it over the years has grown and grown, especially after buying the DVD and listening to the commentaries. And I just want to say I highly recommend that, because what Lumet says, what the writer says, and what Al Pacino say really fill in the pieces of what made that movie what it is. And it's interesting because they all attribute different aspects in prep that changed. And as you're listening, you go, oh, my God, if you hadn't changed that. Al Pacino said his main problem, he said it was a great script, but what does the main character want? Why does he want to do this? You know, and he realized that there was a hole in his soul. He's explaining this to Lumet and the writer. And this hole can only be filled by doing things for people. So in every scene, he's trying to help everyone. And if you think about it, he's always asking if they're comfortable, you know, he's always asking, you know, he's trying to get in a sex change operation, you know.
Right. For Chris Sarandon. Right.
Yes. And he's always worried about John Cassale, you know, and that he's going outside to get pizzas and all that. You know? So that drives him in that compulsion. And it was a very, very solid idea. And it was picked up by the writer. The other thing I learned about that movie was that they wanted to make it feel like it was shot truly in a location. No, they did not want any stage work. So they found an empty warehouse, I think it was, in a street which had the sun where they wanted it, because that was very important. And they built the bank into that. So it's as if they production design by scouting this one section of New York and then put their bank there so they could shoot it. And that's where they went every day. And the thing about Lumet and New York, and let's face it, he's the prince of the city, you know.
He shot almost all of his movies there, like all but two or three or something. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, and they asked in an interview, they asked him, what's the secret? And he said, don't change anything. Leave it like it is. Maybe a sign or two, if you know, but don't change anything, and don't worry about the people in the background.
They
will get bored. And they'll go about what they're doing.
You know? Yeah, in the commentary for Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, Ethan Hawke talks about people in the background and goes, "Are they extras?" And Sidney was like, "No, they're just people that just walk by." He wasn't worried about it. In terms of rehearsals in his book and that Making Movies book, which is great. And that's one of the things I found so charming about Sidney Lumet as a person was that he could speak about his art so fluidly and so kind of conversationally. He didn't on his commentaries and in the book, he doesn't come across as sort of very pretentious. He's very just kind of nuts and bolts kind of guy. But in terms of rehearsal, that's obviously a luxury, right? Most directors don't get that kind of prep time.
Right, but what's the trade-off, okay? Mm. If you rehearse the scenes beforehand and everyone's sure of what they do, when the actors hit the set, the DP knows where the camera's going to go. So a pre-rig is a gift. They're pre-rigging the lights, they're pre-rigging the camera. It's not, you don't have to wait for a rehearsal to pre-rig. Mm. And that's a big amount of time. Then when the actors hit the set, you may walk it once, but then you're shooting, and usually it's two takes and moving on. So he does 8 to 10 hour days. So he's paid for that rehearsal time many times over.
Right. By getting it done quickly. And that was something else they talked about in this book that I read about him, the Maura Siegel's Sidney Lumet, A Life, is that virtually every one of his movies came in under budget and under schedule, like a day or two early, which is, you know, that's got to be something that studios appreciate when he's not spending as much money as anyone expected.
Well, also, looking at it from a director's point of view, someone whose career and whose love is doing one movie a year, he's a pretty cagey card player. And he uses the same AD. And if the AD says, how long do you think this will take? 2.5 hours? And Lumet says 2, but put down 2.5. You know, he's not padding it because it's still faster than most people will do. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Clint Eastwood does the same thing. Mm-hmm. So they always come in under, even though their schedules to any studio executive would look absurdly tight considering the, you mean you're going to do like 2 takes with Sean Connery? Get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean? I mean, let's look at it. One of the great examples is in The Verdict. There's a walk and talk where James Mason and Paul Newman and his friend, who passed away this year, great actor, are walking through the whole place, and they come down a flight of stairs, and it's like a one-er, mm-hmm. you know? And, oh, what is his name? He's in Shampoo also.
I'm blanking on who that is.
Yeah. So anyway, they get to the bottom of the stairs, and they make it, you know, and basically the villain, you know, James Mason says, I'll see you. Is it James Mason?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'll see you in court. And his friend looks at him like, you're going to see him in court? Yeah. He says, yeah, I can take him. And his friend says, he's the fucking devil. And it's just one beautiful shot. And the timing could not be better. And you could practically hear Lamette say, all right, let's move on. You know, someone else would sweat it. Did I get that right? Is, you know, should we cover at the bottom of the stairs? I mean, it's James Mason. It's, you know, Paul Newman. We should get close. No, it lands big, you know.
I mean, you worked a lot. You worked a lot in TV. And obviously, you said Lumet came from television back when. And they, again, in the book that I read, they talked about people that he worked with where they said they were, it was almost eerie how preternaturally he was good at it. He was able to cut it in his head. And able to tell somebody, you know, in 5 seconds, cut this. In 7 seconds, go to that. And he just had that ability to sort of put it all together in his head and be able to tell the people who he was working with, you know, give clear instructions on how to do it and piece it together.
Absolutely.
And is that, I mean, is that why, like I said, when I read about 12 Angry Men, how 12 Angry Men was put together, that, you know, all of Lee J. Cobb's reaction shots were done in one clump while they had him, and then all of Edward Binns, and then all of John Fiedler. And I thought the amount of precision in your head that you have to be able to keep all that together. And is that just, you think it's from those years of working in television, working in live television, working with those actors and being able to coax them into those performances where Lee J. Cobb has got to know, well, all right, I'm at a 3 at this point in the story, and then I'm at a 7 at this point, but I'm doing it all together. That's got to come from his ability to have the relationship with the actors that he's working with, right?
Okay, let's talk about what's necessary to cover and shoot a scene. I think that'll help, you know. So you have 12 guys in this thing.
Little space, yeah.
That's a lot of people to be blocked in any one shot, okay? And you have one room to do it in. Now, the other part of what's filling the room is the lights and camera equipment, all trying to fit in this one space, whether it's a studio room or not. To change direction takes time. And one of the common things in a television, and you can do it in movies, is you do it in television because the group of people have worked together long enough so they really know how long something's going to take. And that's called block shooting. You shoot everything in this direction that you can. Now, that also helps the fact that you don't have to move any other furniture. And I say that because if you're on a location, you've got one door to the room, mm-hmm. or most two. You got to carry everything out of the room, right? And the first thing the DP says, get all this out of here, you know? And it goes out. That means everybody comes in that one door. So you point out what you're going to do and you start doing it. And with actors of that quality, what you can do, if you're going to block shoot them for a length of time, you can get to modulate their performance because they are in that mode. Mm-hmm. So if you're smart, when you block shoot, you block shoot in numerical order so that you are in the early part of the movie, then you move to the middle part, then you move to the end, you know, and you become aware of how far into the scene, into the movie, you want to block shoot in this sequence.
Okay.
And then sometimes you want to stop at a certain point and shoot around for everyone else and then do that. That is how we did certainly the TV, I've done it on every TV series, but it was certainly the way we worked on Moonlighting. Because Sybil Shepherd was best in the morning. You know?
Okay.
She's a morning person, and Bruce Willis was a night person. And Sybil had to get there early for makeup. And by 5 o'clock, she just felt like she wasn't looking her best and her energy was lower. So we shot everything of Sybil. We did the opposite of block shooting. We shot everything of Sybil, no matter where she was in the room, first. We did a complete rehearsal. We took out the furniture. We put down the floor. We put down the tape marks, and we do it that way. And what happened is we would gain this momentum of energy because Sybil was this scene, this scene, this scene. And Bruce was watching her and reacting to her as he woke up, as his senses woke up, you know? So when we turned around on Bruce after lunch, he knew what he was going to do in every shot, and he'd improvise on it. And I am convinced. Also, here's a little note. Sybil Shepherd on Moonlighting only looks camera left. She felt she looked best that way, and I had to learn how to stage everything that way. Bruce is always looking camera right. And I am convinced that the reason Bruce had such a meteoric rise is that he was a method actor who used his method technique to create a character like David Addison, that no matter what you threw with David Addison, he was David Addison. David Addison could be in Taming of the Shrew. It's still the same guy.
He could be
in prison. He could be, right? No matter what the case was. And he knew all of Sybil's reactions, and he embroidered on it. And it made him the lovable wise ass. Because he was the kid in the back of the room who, you know how you leave a situation and go, ah, shit, I wish I said that.
Yes.
Bruce left nothing on the table.
Right. Okay. All right.
That makes sense. And so someone as shrewd as Lumet in that room knew how far to block shoot ahead. My worst experience with block shooting, okay, was on Heroes. And I've done so much block shooting. We did 11 scenes on this episode in a hall of mirrors.
Oh, Lord.
Yes. So we started experiment. And once you found the place that the camera could go and not see the crew and so forth, you didn't want to move. Right? So we shot all 11 scenes in a row from this camera position. And we moved to another camera position and hide everything and line up and do that. And that meant everybody had to remember what they did in those 11 scenes. And you know what? We finished up 3 hours early on the second day. And it turned out really cool. But it was a mind bender, you know?
My God. Yeah, I mean, he obviously had a marvelous relationship with actors because a lot of the same people appeared, both big and small. You know, he did 5 things with Sean Connery. And from what I heard, Sean Connery wasn't always the easiest person to work with. But obviously... He had a good relationship with Connery, and part of it had to be because he was giving, especially with the Connery movies, he was giving Connery lots of unusual things to do that were not, because he was, as everyone knows, he was sick of James Bond, and he got to be in The Offense. He did The Offense, which is the cop drama, and they did the Anderson tapes, which you mentioned earlier, which again is kind of unusual in that how it's rhythmically edited in a certain way for that film. The Hill.
I think I've seen that film 3 or 4 times. I should watch it again. It's a pretty good caper film, right?
The Anderson Tapes?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a load of fun. Yeah,
Is that the one where the van goes inside the truck?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, yeah. It's really fun. It's much more lighthearted than I expected. I thought it was. Right. It's really good. And then he did The Hill, the war film, and then, of course, Murder on the Orient Express. And my favorite thing about that was, like, the story about how did he get all those people to be in it. And he said, you go for the biggest star first, and then everybody gets in line. And that was Connery. And he got Connery, and then everyone else said, oh, Sean Connery's doing it. I'll do it. And then he did Family Business in 1989 with Sean Connery.
Yeah, that was a CAA package that failed.
But then you mentioned James Mason. He did a couple of movies with James Mason.
By the way, truly a great, great actor. And as a producer, and as someone watching their career, really took a lot of chances, you know? The movie he produced, Bigger Than Life, that Nicholas Ray
movie,
directed.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, what actor would take that chance to not just be in it, but to do it, to say, I'm going to produce this because I want to play a man who's addicted to, you know,
cortisone. Yeah, yeah. He's going to kill his child in the movie.
Oh, yeah. Yes, you know who loves that movie? Marty Scorsese.
That's how I know about it. I'd never heard about it until his documentary, and then he mentioned it, and I was like, I got to see this movie. And then I went and bought it, and it's absolutely marvelous. But something that Lumet talks about in making movies, and again is quoted in the other book that I read, is that he – and it's kind of, I'm thinking about when you said about Bruce Willis, about where he could be David Addison in any situation.
Right.
So, you know, he was ready no matter what came up, he could be in character and it would be appropriate because he's being the character. Is that he gave, like I said, he gave the actors the space he felt they needed to be their best selves and be creative. And it's like, that seems to be a pretty big part of being a good film director that maybe is not as considered because it's seemingly invisible. You can't look at it on the film and pick it up, but that's behind the scenes. But that's how it's working, is that he's given. I mean, obviously Pacino, we worked with Pacino company, you know, the guy knew how to give the space to whatever actor. And like you're talking about, Cybill Shepherd's good in the morning and Bruce Willis is Bader, like having to juggle all those different constituencies, that had to be really difficult for him.
And you think about Al Pacino in a movie like Dog Day Afternoon. He gave him physical space in the frame so that when he's running back and forth in the bank, there's plenty of space to see him and to get a sense of it's only one, it's like two rooms. And his movement in that gave the film a manic energy. And the choice he made in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which is an interesting thing because the movie is such an intense actor's piece that when I listened to the commentary, it was so clear that there was nothing else in this movie but these scenes of these actors, you know, that's really all it was in these small spaces, you know, going at each other with all these tremendous emotional problems and that it was a melodrama. That's what he keeps saying, that it's a melodrama. And the writer said, we thought it was an action thriller. No, it's a melodrama. Mm-hmm. He kept saying the story drives the actors, you know, and he decided to do it on digital with two cameras. So he could turn these actors loose in these hyperbolic situations and get everything at the same time. So the actors could overlap, they could improvise, and he says that the scene in the car where Philip Hoffman is with his
Marcy
wife,
Tomei, yeah,
and he's saying life's not fair, is one of the best scenes he's ever directed. And it's just the two of them in two singles. And throughout the piece, you realize that he's getting the reaction and the scene at the same time. And thus he's instructing his DP. You have to light it that way. So you do make a sacrifice in terms of if it's never going to look like an Academy Award winning cinematography, you know, because of that, you're shooting in two directions, but what you gain in spontaneity, and what you gain in being in the moment, I can truly appreciate. I mean, when on Crossing Jordan, which was a series I executive produced and directed, and it was about a morgue.
Right.
So there was many, many scenes where the main characters would confront people or be with people who had just had someone die. Very emotional scenes. And we leaned into those scenes. And when I would see them in the script and I'd go with my first AD and block out where we're going to do it, I would go and ask the DP, what do I have to do in this scene? So you can shoot Jordan and the guest star, whatever it was, talking about the death of the guest star's daughter in crossing angles. So I only have to do it once for them and maybe in a two shot. And he would absorb that and make a suggestion where in the room they could be, for instance, in front of a table. And he says, frame out the top of the table. And he would put a white sheet of paper there. So now that's their fill light. right? Mm-hmm. And you'd have to light them with back crosses, and you couldn't get right behind them because you'd see the lighting instrument. So we would design these setups that looked great, but allowed the actors to have that freedom. And then before a take, you'd say, you can't lean too far forward this way and back, and then they go and do it, and you'd get it in two or three takes. And you could say, I love where you both are at this point in the scene. Let's go back to like the middle of this part and pick it up from there. And you really got to a higher level of performance. Hmm. And there are directors like Barry Levinson who always shoot that way. And Robert Altman always shot that way.
He was asked at the time of what he thought about shooting digitally. And he said he was all for it because he said the quote was, shooting film, working with film was a pain in the ass, which I thought is a very unromantic view of it. You would think maybe somebody from his generation would be more like, no, 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 film or nothing. But he was like, no, no, this is it's a lot easier to do digital.
Yeah, well, you know, you're shooting at 800 ASA digitally. And you don't shoot at film, you go up to 400, which means that you're carrying less lights, you know. And if you're looking for something that has a certain feeling to it, like I did this TV series called Nashville. And Nashville was a family show. So we had a lot of teens and so forth in scenes with pros, grown up adults. And they came up with the idea of using three cameras, crossing and one other for another shot. And what that did is allowed the kids to not worry about matching.
Okay.
Oh, and allowed them to be who they were. And you would get through the scenes quicker, which would help their patience.
Sure.
And to do that, it was seemingly lit by the practical lights in the room. And if you can get away with that, with digital, I've shot shows on digital that walking on the set, you got to have your flashlight on because you can't see anything. It's all lit with candles, you know.
Wow. Before you were talking about before The Devil Knows Your Dad, and we do want to get into that because it is his final. It is his final film. But before that, I do want to, across his filmography, you know, anyone who's done as many films as he has. You know, I go into it thinking, oh, I've seen a lot of his movies, and then I go through it on IMDb, and I go, geez.
Yeah,
there's 25 movies of his I haven't seen. Were there, when you were going back and watching some of his films in anticipation of this, were there any that you had not seen that you were like, wow, that was terrific? I did that just sort of fell through the cracks over the years.
Oh, yes, and I it kind of lines up with the experience that I've had in being a completist, right, and trying to see all his work. I remember seeing Bye Bye Braverman years ago and being disappointed in it. You know? Equus, I was just, it's just not for me. You know? I do owe myself another screening of Murder on the Orient Express.
Love that movie.
And Just
so
Tell
much.
Me What You Want came out on Warner Archives, so I got that, and that's not very good. neither is Death Trap to me. But.
Oh, you don't like Death Trap?
Okay, I'll give it another try.
I love Death Trap.
I got my pen out.
I love Death Trap. All right.
I should give Daniel another try. I've seen
that's
it.
Terrific. I saw that for the first time for this recording. That's a terrific movie. I really enjoyed that.
Now, Garbo Talks, no.
Haven't seen that one.
And Power, I don't remember it working very well.
Okay.
But The Morning After is one of his movies that works really well and has some big flaws in it.
Okay.
You know, and Andrei Barkojiak does a beautiful job of it. But one of his movies that is really, to me, very, very moving and powerful is Running on Empty.
That's a great movie.
That is a great movie. And his directing of the actors in that movie is so, so much of his style, you know. When Judd Hirsch finds out that his father has died, and there's no way he can find out because he's in a wide shot in a New York City street, he sits down on the bumper of a truck. There's no close-up.
Mm-hmm.
His body language in the brilliance of that, and the birthday party where they dance around to the James Taylor song. And the depth of emotions in that. It's a great movie. Family Business, nah. But Q&A. Look, when I say nah, I should do a movie as good as Family, you know. Let me set a little context here. On Rotten Tomatoes, Heartbeeps gets a zero. Okay, so let's let's call it like we see it. Now, I got a ton of Emmy nominations, and I've got a DGA awards and all that. But that was a zero, and Caddyshack 2 was a 17%. So it's a grain of salt. Toss out the, you know.
Could Sidney Lumet have worked with Andy Kaufman, though? I mean, no. You know, well, there you go. No,
he could not have worked with Jackie Mason either. And you know what? This guy should have known better. Anyway. Q&A has like two-thirds of a really terrific movie. Mm. You know, at a certain point, the script and the plotting kind of gets it to trip all over itself. It's a little, but another example of outstanding locations. Mm. You're just all these places, and he does not dress them up. So I've seen it now three times. It's really good. A Stranger Among Us I saw when it came out. So you say Critical Care is good?
I really like Critical Care. I think it is very funny. I mean, it's got Albert Brooks in it, and anything with Albert Brooks in it, I'm kind of like, all right, I'm halfway there. But it's a really sharp, to me, incisive thing, a comedy about the medical, you know, the world of medical insurance and hospitals. Yeah. And really funny with some great performances. James Spader's terrific in it.
Right.
That's another one that I just saw off from the video store. I was like, I don't even heard of it. What is this? And then I watched, this is terrific. And I thought it was, yeah, I think that's a great, underrated
now,
little movie.
Night Falls on Manhattan, I have drawn a blank on.
That's pretty good. It's Andy Garcia and Ian Holm and James Gandolfini. Right. Great cast. It reminds me a lot of the 70s cop movies that he did. You know, it's like but it came 16 years after Prince of the City, but it feels like it's
which is the one with Vin Diesel?
That's Find Me Guilty.
Yeah, I went first night.
Didn't do it for you?
No. But Before the Devil Knows We're Dead is not the movie of an old man.
Nope.
It is maybe one of the greatest last movies that anyone has ever made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know Liberty Valance is not a last movie, but it feels like it, you know.
Mm.
And Howard Hawks and Rio Lobo, and you know, you could go down the line of these movies that are tired, but it's certainly energized, and it has a bleak worldview where he basically says that everyone in this family is trash. You know?
Well, that's a perfect time. For people who haven't seen it, I want to get into the plot very briefly in the cast so people know what we're talking about. It came out on October 26th, 2007. I guess I'll do a very brief plot synopsis here. So
sure.
It's two brothers, Andy and Hank Hansen, are each facing crippling money problems. Andy's company, from which he has embezzled, is facing an IRA audit. Hank is divorced and struggling to pay child support to his ex-wife, Martha. Complicating things even further is the fact that Hank is having an affair with Andy's wife, Gina. Andy concocts a plan to rob his parents' jewelry store and bullies Hank into being part of it. They plan to rob the store when an employee of their parents will be the only one there, and then they'll fence the diamonds. Thinking their parents will then simply be made good by insurance, they look at it like it's a victimless crime. Hank hires an experienced crook named Bobby to pull the robbery off. Unfortunately, filling in for the employee is Andy and Hank's mother, Nanette. Grabbing a gun from a drawer, she shoots Bobby, but not before he returns fire, gravely injuring Nanette. Bobby is killed. The plan now having gone completely awry, Andy and Hank have to comfort their father, Charles, pretending not to know how any of this happened. The noose tightens on Andy and Hank. Andy retreats further into his drug habit while his employers try to get him back into the office to deal with the books before the IRS arrives. Meanwhile, Bobby's widow and brother-in-law, Hank, find Hank and demand he pay them for Bobby's death so as not to leave his family destitute. Charles eventually learns that his sons were behind the robbery and tails them. After robbing and murdering his drug dealer, Andy and Hank go to Bobby's widow's house where Andy is shot. Hank takes off with the money and Andy is brought to a hospital. Charles finds him there and smothers his son with a pillow. As nurses rush in, Charles walks out of the hospital. Philip Seymour Hoffman plays Andy. Ethan Hawke is Hank. Marissa Tomei is Gina. Albert Finney is Charles. Michael Shannon plays Dex. Amy Ryan is Martha. Rosemary Harris is Nanette. Brian F. O'Byrne is Bobby. And Aleska Palladino is Chris. It was written by Kelly Masterson, whose probably most famous credit is Snowpiercer. Now, the most amazing thing I found out about this movie from the book, I think, I don't think they mentioned it in the audio commentary, was that in the original script, Hank and Andy are not brothers.
Yes, that's true.
And it was Lumet. Lumet. Yeah. And I thought to myself, that's the movie.
Yes.
That's the whole story, is that they're brothers. And that it was Lumet that added that. I thought that's unbelievable.
Because it ups the stakes of having the affair with his wife.
Yeah.
And it puts the onus on the father, who you assume is kind of a hero in this. But what did he do to those two sons mm-hmm. that made them be that way? That gave them no sense of morality.
One of the themes of the movie is that, of course, that Charles, played by Albert Finney, again, he worked with Lumet on Murder on the Orient Express, is that he treated Hank as the, they treated Hank as the favorite. And right. that means Andy is resentful, and then there's a sister in the movie too, who kind of only is on the periphery. I think there's only truly one scene. And it's sort of funny that you could sort of get a sense that the sister has just not participated in all of this drama. She's just kind of like, okay, yeah. I don't know what. But the anger that they have towards the father because they were treated so unfairly is, again, incredibly powerful.
And Hank is such a loser.
Yeah. Right. His ex-wife is Amy Ryan, and she wants child support, and he can't pay it. It's so like Amy Ryan as usual is terrific.
Right,
there's that scene where the daughter needs money for the school trip. And
yes.
Amy Ryan's character knows that Hank can't pay for it, but she, instead of telling the daughter, no, we're not gonna be able to do that, she says, go ask your father, which of course means Hank has to break the bad news, which he is yeah. not capable of doing. And that's what puts him into this. They're just all so vicious to one another in this movie.
You know, it's a really, what every scene is loaded up with baggage, you know, emotional baggage that has to be considered as the actors play it. There's no expository scenes, so to speak, that feel expository. It's all these emotional interplays. And you can't imagine the movie without them being brothers. It's like you can't imagine His Girl Friday not being better than the front page because it's a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to say to Ben Hecht, who said, it shouldn't just be a man and a woman. It's his ex-wife. Genius.
There you go.
Right? So it's a way of having all this emotional load and really having the joy as a director and a writer to have all this stuff to dig into and for the actors. And in rehearsal, seeing what the actors brought to it, that choosing to shoot them both at once, you know, and so forth. And he said he did very, very little to the locations. That the sex worker's apartment is exactly like they found it. Nothing
he
changed.
Mentions that, yeah. An amazing apartment.
And Marissa Tomei's apartment, he left it, they changed a little bit, but he says, I just left it as ugly as it was.
I think he talks about in the sex worker, there's the wall has like this big red triangle.
Right.
Like black and red divided. And he's like, that was really there. That's what that guy's apartment.
And that character is like, what is that person with their silk pajamas on and their closet full of different drugs with hypodermic needles? I mean, his whole trip was, you know, something weird. So
knowing what happened to Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's tough to watch those scenes where he's
very much so.
Shooting drugs because you know that this was something in his real life. And one of the things I had learned about, again, I think in the book, was they said when he was shooting the movie, he went to Philip Seymour Hoffman and said, man, Ethan Hawke is just killing it in this movie. He is just, and then he went to Ethan Hawke and said, man, Philip Seymour Hoffman is just killing it in this movie. Sort of like gently pitting them against each other, which I thought was really funny. And they mentioned that in the commentary. They both find it very funny that it was like, yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah, and they're wonderful together. And you can tell in the commentary how much they respect each other and how much they love working together. And how gracious Sidney Lumet is talking about people, even the daughter. Look at her in the background. She's waving the, you know, something around. She's excited. The little girl never stopped acting, you know.
Now, you said that you feel like it's not the work. It's not like the work of an old man. And that's
in the traditional sense, but it's the work of a wise man.
Right, right. Not someone who's tired and has nothing left to say and is just wants to keep his hand in it because that's what he does. Right. But it's, so, I mean, why do you say that exactly? I mean, I agree, but I mean,
I think what we're seeing is when I joined the Directors Guild in the early 80s, the average lifespan of a director was 53 years.
Lifespan career or lifespan?
Lifespan life.
Wow.
There's a lot of ADs and a lot of production managers and a lot of directors smoking and drinking and dying young.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, no.
And as time went on, a lot of directors experienced huge changes in the business that they did not keep up with because it was part of a huge social movement. So you're asking an experienced director to all of a sudden use widescreen, you know, and thus do less cuts. And, you know, Vincent Minnelli did as good as what he could, but his widescreen movies are not as interesting, and neither is George Cukor's, you know, except maybe A Star Is Born. But all that stuff changed them, and television changed them. So their careers, for whatever reasons, many of the most auteur directors, stuff started seeming old-fashioned because their themes and the recurring of their themes made them feel repetitious.
Mm.
And so when you look at some of the Hitchcock's last movies, you know, The Birds is a genius work, you know. But sort of after that, some of the tropes and stuff become a little tired. And it's understandable. There's only so many hours you can stand on a set, you know.
Right.
I have directed 200 television hours of television and movies and produced another 200. And I once did the math and the number of pages that I have read in my life, the number of setups. But here's the thing that got me the most. How much time of my life, so I've been a director for 47, 48 years. How much time of my life have I spent in a location van? Right? Because you go on this van, you go once the first day, then you go to pick up the rest of them, and then you do it again for the tech scout. That's not to say you don't go in between. 2 full years of my life in a location van. So there is all of that aspect to it, you know, and so many of the classic directors' work suffers from the fact that the times change so much under them, and the actors' attitude are really clear examples of the generation gap. Now you have someone like Lumet, you have someone like Scorsese, who are revitalized because they now have as much power as they had before. Because they are treated like precious natural forces, you know?
Right, 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 sure.
You know? Yeah, Marty, shoot for 5 months. It doesn't, you know. Which would you rather have, the money or a Marty Scorsese picture?
Right, sure.
Yeah. You know? And so many of them do that. There is better health care. They don't smoke and drink, you know? I'm sure Marty has some sort of exercise thing. Listen, from my point of view, I wish I had started doing Pilates 25 years ago. I know this sounds mundane, you know, but you start shooting at 7 a.m. on Monday morning and you don't wrap till 4 a.m. Friday night.
Oof.
Right? Because towards the end of the week, you start doing your night shoots. So that you can turn around on the weekend. That means that half of Saturday is a blur.
Right.
And Sunday you sit down and prep for the week.
Oof. Yeah.
You know? And so if you're a producer director, it's worse because you have to read every script and so forth. And that's what I was on 10 different shows. So that takes a toll. And it just, gets to you. So, yet with the way, what other directors have seen that do great work in their later years of the newer generation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Brian De Palma, whether you like the movies or not, they don't seem like an old man's movies. I probably, if we had a list, I could go down the list and, you know, so I think what we have is directors who adapted to the times and were able to include their particular character obsessions into the people of the times. And they were, this is going to sound funny, they were not Republicans. Okay. And here's why I say that. Republicans all the time complain that there are no movies about Republican subject matters, that Hollywood is prejudiced against making movies. The reason is because if you're a Republican, you do not have the mental and emotional, you know, build to you to care about what other people think. And to have that, the word that, empathy.
And Roger Ebert said movies are empathy machines. Yeah.
All about empathy and the ability to laugh at yourself, you know. You don't see a lot of hard right Republican stand-ups. Not going to happen, you know. And so you must also have enormous amount of curiosity because you want to see different things in the world. When you see someone like John Huston, he came for a weekend at the DGA, and they asked him what the most important thing to him was as throughout the years. And he said, interest, meaning I'm interested in everything. And that's why people like Scorsese, and that's why John Huston, I mean, the man who would be king, you know, and The Dead and all those great movies show a kind of restless mind and stuff like that. And I hate to pick on the Republicans, but this is not part of that anymore. Those guys, and I'm talking about Ford and some of them, as the world shifted to the right, to the left, they became less interested in it as opposed to learning about it.
I mean, Lumet absolutely, obviously has an empathy.
That was a word from our leftist sponsor here.
I mean, Lumet obviously has a deep concern for all kinds of different people, and the characters in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, I mean, you empathize with them, even though they're all pretty, I mean, certainly you empathize with Gina, you know, I mean, she's not so bad. I mean, she's having an affair with, but okay, or whatever, we all, but like, I didn't dislike any of them, even though they do horrible things. I mean, you know, I mean, the idea that like that Andy talks Hank into robbing his families, and they are just like, well, yeah, all right, we could do. And you're like, what are you?
It's because they're, and because of the writers and the directors are closer to Dostoevsky than they are to a Law and Order candidate.
Right.
Right. That they are interested in what makes a person do that. And someone else would have done a different movie about trying to get them arrested.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's not a crime thriller. It's sold like it's a crime thriller. It's not. It's a melodrama. Now, one of the things that is unique about it, I mean, it's not, is that it's told out of sequence. Mm-hmm. We see the opening scene, we see the robbery go wrong. And so we know, okay, this is...
I wonder when that came in.
What do you feel like that added something to it?
Tremendously. Tremendously. And also because you were so mysterious as to what was going on. And then you got to see it, and it made it twice as bad the second time. You know, when you got to know the guy a little bit, and he did it again, you know, you saw it for the second time. I wonder at what stage that was in, whether it was in the original script or was something that was added.
Yeah, I don't think he mentions it in the commentary, but I mean, do you think it's because it has that creeping dread of we've already now know it's gone wrong. And so seeing Hank get talked into it by Andy as
You just hit it right on the head. I hadn't thought about it. This entire movie is filled with dread. Throughout the whole thing, there is an anxiety as a viewer because you are desperately trying to find someone you can identify with. You know, that thing of complicity that is so much a part of a movie. In this case, you don't feel complicitous, you know, and he has all the skill and he pulls it off anyway because they're all horrible, you know.
Right.
But they're all, you begin to understand why they are who they are. And the deep unhappiness of Marissa Tomei and the guy who's the help with the robbery who has to wake and bake.
Yeah. You know? Guy's great. He listens to the heavy metal music to get it. I love he says to get in character. I think. Yes.
And, crazy. You know, the guy who calls him Groucho and Harpo and Chico, you know, his cruelty, you know.
Michael Shannon, always great.
Michael Shannon's great in it. You know?
Always so threatening. And every time you see him, oh, shit, something's about to happen.
Yeah. And so I think that in his pursuit throughout his life of clarity in his directing and clarity of what he saw in human nature, whether and what he saw as the villain, like in The Verdict, it's the doctor who lied. The doctor who knew this might kill him, but out of expediency, because he made the mistake, he made the nurse change her mind.
Right, change the
she
form.
She was so frightened that she walked away from it all. And yet you have James Mason, who loves crushing Paul Newman.
Right.
And so I think that Lumet finally said, here's my real statement about what's out there. And this is how I see it. The way that The Irishman is. The Irishman is a summation of Scorsese's creative life. And it's his Liberty Valance. And it's him taking these characters to the logical extreme of death. And we are lucky as film lovers to follow this group of people from their first appearance of John Boy blowing up a mailbox in Mean Streets. You know, we don't have to look to the past of John Wayne and how Ford worked them. We have lived with these people and seen Scorsese's growth as an artist, but his reach and his grasp and so forth. And so you can look at Lumet and get that same effect, you know.
Yeah. Like I said, especially the last bunch of his movies are all kind of different. I mean, with he's working in different genres. I mean, that Critical Care is... It's serious, but it's still a comedy, and he hadn't done that many comedies to that point.
Did you watch 100 Center Street?
I can't find it anywhere. That's his TV show. I can't. Yeah, I looked for it. Yeah, I couldn't find. In fact, there's an interesting story in the book about that. They were shooting that on 9/11. They were literally shooting it, and of course, everyone heard what happened. And he said to his crew, "If you want to go home, obviously." Go home. But he stayed in working. He stayed working because he was like, this is what comforts me is the routine of working. And you know, he said, if you want to go home, go home. But he feels like I'm here. I want to do it. And that's, you know, I mean, that's extraordinary that at that age he had the energy again, like you're talking about to do that.
That show was shot so efficiently. He still put in 8 or 9 hour days and they did 6 or 7 pages a day, you know. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wish I could find that somewhere.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, yeah, the scene in Before the Devil where Philip Seymour Hoffman finally talks to his father about that, you know, you always treated me and, you know, you and mom and dad, you and mom loved Hank more than you loved me.
Yeah.
It's this, you know, out in the backyard of their house. And it's incredibly raw and painful. And Hoffman is, you know, Andy is baring his soul to his dad. And what is his dad's reaction? He slaps him.
Yeah.
He slaps him because he makes the comment about, am I even your son? Yeah. And you can see, well, geez, maybe, okay, that's like, if that's your dad, maybe that's why you grow up kind of effed in the head like that. If that is the, and by the way, Albert Finney, I love Albert Finney. I always have. I think he was the best Poirot ever, just in that one shot he did in Murder on the Orient Express. But I love that scene where he's at the police station, and he's trying to get the cops to investigate this murder of his wife. Right. And the one cop just gets up and he sees him there, and he puts his arm out like, don't even talk to me. I'm first thing in the morning, I'm just walking in. And then you see Albert Finney get in his car and smash the cop car with his car. Right. That's what made me laugh. So he's so frustrated. But
there's a couple of things I just want to mention that I got listening to the commentary.
Yeah.
Okay. To start a movie with a sex scene like that, you don't know who these people are, mm-hmm. you know, is one thing where it gets you off balance, mm-hmm. and it gets you to say, don't expect the expected, mm-hmm. you know. Ethan Hawke's post-robbery freak out, again, very early in the movie, you know. Mm-hmm. Lumet said, a director must find and know the emotional levels to each scene, where to pitch it. And that is certainly a hallmark of his abilities. Mm-hmm. You know, he chose banal locations on purpose. This is a really ugly parking lot. Let's shoot it here. The killing spree at the end, he just wanted to be so deranged. And the bit with the pillow was something that Seymour Hoffman came up with on the spot.
The shooting through the pillow?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the line, are we good? Mm-hmm. It decimated. That was improvised. The story determines the characters, which is melodrama to him. He made them brothers. We talked about this. He said he made them brothers so every scene would be more fraught.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that that was his addition, because it just,
yeah,
that's why you make the movie, is that it's the family drama of these guys.
He said that rehearsal is what helps him evolve the style of the movie, and both Ethan Hawke and Seymour Hoffman said that it's not a movie of an older man, it's the movie of someone in their 30s.
Hmm.
And that's certainly true of The Wolf of Wall Street too.
Hmm. Yeah. Could it be part of it is that by this point you're talking about, like you said, they go to Scorsese and they say shoot for five months, it's fine. Is that at this point somebody at Lumet's level in 2007, and certainly Martin Scorsese, has a team of people around them that absolutely. They've worked with for so long that it's
no got doubt.
Yeah,
absolutely. He had the same. He talks about his first AG, Joe Reedy. You can't book Joe Reedy anymore. Joe Reedy works at Lumet, Scorsese, and Mike Nichols. Who, you know, you got time for me? And so you have a team around you, you know, and in his book, he talks about his routine. He actually takes a nap at lunch. To be able to turn off your brain enough to take a nap is astonishing to me. And I lie down at lunch, and every day for lunch, he has the same thing. He has cold cuts with no bread. So I'm sure Scorsese has an army around him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know that Marty, when he sits down at the monitor, wants to have mirrors on both sides of the monitor so he can see who's behind him. You know,
wow.
They know that when Marty walks on the set, nobody talks ever.
Hmm.
You know, no sound. It has to be quiet, you know, that kind of thing. You go on a TV set, it can drive you nuts, you know, how much is going on. And anyone in the crew can come up to the director and ask him a question at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to keep your concentration and focus is a bit of a challenge. I don't think anyone could go up to Marty or Sidney Lumet or any of these people without first going up to the first AD and asking when is a good time.
Gotcha. Okay.
You have to marshal your energies.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I've always been fascinated by, we've been doing the show and talking about some of these final films, like, did they know it was their final film? Did they go into now? Lumet lived until 2013. By the way, nominated for 5 Oscars, never won. Got one. He got an honorary Oscar, which is great, but still, it seems unbelievable that somebody...
I think that Altman knew that that was going to be his final film.
Well, you think Robert Altman knew when he did, Prairie Home Companion?
Yes, it feels like it.
Okay.
He surrounded himself with a cast. There is a sunset quality to the subject matter and to how the people feel. But now, interestingly enough, here's a thing. In an interview, Scorsese thought that he was going to die before he made Raging Bull. He had drug problems and health problems, et cetera, mental issues and pressure. And it was De Niro who pulled him away and went on vacation, and they wrote that script together. They rewrote it on vacation.
Wow.
And he said at a certain point, he just said in interviews, I thought my days were numbered, you know? And so I directed it like I would never direct another.
It's got that energy, doesn't it? Yeah. So like Lumet, said he lived until 2013. Now in the book that I read, they apparently he dabbled with some things and maybe looked into, but at a certain point, he knew that was it. I think when his health started to really deteriorate.
Same thing with Mike Nichols. They keep their hand in, but everyone knows they're really not going to make that. You know?
Right. So obviously, he said he was happy with the legacy, knowing that that was the end of his film career. And he said, it's an awake movie. It's not the work of someone asleep at the switch. It's a vital, you know, powerful drama. Again, these actors working at the top of their game in this. I guess I watch Albert Finney do anything. By the way, the ending of the movie where he smothers his son.
Yeah.
In your mind, do you feel that he is doing it out of revenge or doing it to save his son from going to jail? Because obviously Andy is not
doing it. He's doing it to kill his mistakes.
Okay.
And I think it was Philip Hoffman who said that when he read the script, he thought it was profound that the father took the heartbeat, you know,
the monitors and attached him to himself,
the son, and put it on himself and then killed the son. It's tragic.
Yeah.
It's tragic. You know?
It's a terrific, terrific movie. So we're going to wrap up here. There is one other thing I want to mention about Sidney Lumet, which is not connected to Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Okay.
But it's just, I had it in my notes and I want to make sure I mention it, is that, like, as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, like Sidney Lumet, not like as flashy as you would think of some other directors, whatever.
Right.
And so when I got to really start appreciating his movies, I read his book, and I really just liked him. Like, I was like, he seems like a nice guy. A guy that you could talk, have a conversation with, and you know, he would probably give you his full attention, you know, if you ran into him on the street or whatever. And so anyway, there is there's a Stanley Kubrick documentary called A Life in Pictures.
Yes, I've seen that, yeah.
Right. Now, when they get to Dr. Strangelove, they have one of the talking heads is Alex Cox. And Alex Cox compares Strangelove to Failsafe, because, of course, they're both about the same subject matter.
Right.
And it was the whole idea was that Kubrick, when he saw the realities of nuclear Armageddon, he just said, well, this can only be made that funny. You can't take it. And so Alex Cox kind of goes out of his way to take a shot at Failsafe and calls it like lugubrious or pedantic or whatever. And I first of all, I like Failsafe. I think Failsafe is highly entertaining, nightmarish, but I remember just, like, I love Stanley Kubrick, but I felt like protective of Sidney Lumet that this guy was kind of knocking him in a documentary a little bit.
The issue of they both came out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you take that away because of reacting and reacting, and it becomes a non-issue, you know? And Kubrick said that a lot of the dialogue actually came out of the Army guidebooks and so forth. And it evolved that way. Dr. Strangelove is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Yeah, I mean, masterpiece, obviously. Yeah. But it was just, like, I don't, you know, successful movie directors are not people that need to be defended by some lowly video store clerk. But I just I just felt it like, wow, don't pick on Sidney Lumet. He's a great director. What are you talking about, Alex Cox?
Okay. Come on. Actually, I got to see, I think it's called Ginger and Fred, the movie Fellini did
Fellini,
about,
right.
Yes, the movie with his wife and Marcello Mastroianni, right. and they're getting back together as a dance team. And, you know, it's a late in life movie. Mm-hmm. And I go to see it in Westwood. And I'm coming out of the theater, and there's these two nicely dressed people, and they're putting on their sunglasses. And I glance at their sunglasses, and I know these are $300 sunglasses, you know? And they just had this attitude about them. And I thought, these are studio people, you know? These are studio exec types. And I'm walking with them, and the guy turns to the woman with all the pompousness, you know, and says, I know it's Fellini, but it's still 20 minutes too long. You know, it's like in an interview with Paul McCartney about the White Album. Mm-hmm. He says, people are always saying it should have been a single record, you know. Which song would you take off of it? It's the Beatles. It's the White Album. Live with it. Glad to have it.
If only that studio guy had been there when Fellini was working on it. That guy would have known. So, okay. Well, we talked about this off air. There is one other last thing I wanted to mention before we're signing off here. Is that, so, you know, I was going through his filmography and watching movies I'd never seen. I'd never seen Long Day's Journey Into Night. I'd never seen The Group.
I actually twice got ready to get it from Amazon. I thought 3.5 hours.
Long Day's Journey is rough going, no doubt about it. But so I watched Long Day's Journey. I watched The Group. I watched Anderson Tapes. I watched Child's Play. I watched.
How did The Group hold up?
It's not bad. It's a little long. They're going to cut 20 minutes. But it's all right. But I mean, so like I said, I watched Daniel, which I thought was absolutely terrific. I watched
Manhattan. Yeah.
And as I watched them, I said to myself, did this guy never make a bad movie? I mean, that seems impossible, right? Well, okay.
All right.
I'm going through his 70s run, which is, again, one of the great runs in any film career history. And you see Serpico, and then there's this thing called Love and Molly. And you're like, what the hell is that? And then he went on to Murder on the Orient Express, which I absolutely love. I've seen it dozens of times. And then Dog Day Afternoon and Network. And the Love and Molly is like the weird Snaggletooth. You're like, wait, what? So I watched that. That is not a good movie.
Okay.
That is not a good
movie. I am so glad that we are at this point. Okay. Let's talk about The Wiz before we go.
Okay. Okay. What do you want to say about The Wiz?
Okay. So in the midst of all these great movies, I went to see The Wiz. You know, I saw it maybe at the Cinerama Dome, you know, and I was very disappointed, you know. Okay. Did not like the movie. I thought it was stodgy. I didn't get it on any level, you know. I thought some of the songs were good, but I just didn't feel like a musical to me. It felt stiff and there was no movement and, you know, and I never thought of it as something in the slightest bit important to me. I taught a seminar in the AFI called The History of African American Music and Movies. Mm. From 1929 to Beyonce at Coachella. Okay, covering how they use music stars to lure in the audience so they wouldn't have to make black people movie stars because there are none in the 30s.
Right, okay.
You know, and just going through the whole thing, and I didn't want to be the white mansplainer for my class. So I made sure I talked to the students, and I got two African-American students to help me and to give their side of it and read what I had done. And they both said to me, where's The Wiz? And I had barely put Lady Sings the Blues on it because it's a bad movie. And I said, oh, why do you like The Wiz? He says, We love The Wiz. Ah. Everyone I know loves The Wiz. Why? He says, because it's us. We saw us up there. I never saw The Wizard of Oz. Now, these are people now in their 20s.
Right.
When we saw The Wiz, I could watch the color-changing sequence over and over and over again. And I said, well, don't you feel it's stiff? And it's just like, no, it's The Wiz. And it has a very, very special place in the hearts of many, many African Americans, okay? I was looking at it as like a lesser Sidney Lumet movie.
Right.
And sometimes I'm going to say you and I look at things from our point of view.
Sure, sure.
And we miss the point. And even though I went back and I watched The Wiz again, and guess what? It was no different than I remembered it. You know, in all honesty, Dee Dee Allen's trying to make it work, but the camera does not move with the music. And the shots are too wide, and there's no sense of flow to it. And it seems to be an anti-musical, and almost every choice is a weird one. When we ran the clip in class, everybody applauded and loved it.
Aww.
So you've got to say that Mr. Lumet has a way of communicating it. And if sometimes he misses it, it's still better than we could do.
No doubt about you know? That.
And this is from the guy who did Rock and Roll High School, and I've seen it a million times with lots of audiences and Get Crazy. So that was kind of the lesson, is like, look at what, how it appeals to the audience and so forth. And it just turned me around. I still have the same opinion of The Wiz, but now I have a new viewpoint of how, what an audience takes away from a movie.
Right. Right. Well, you know what? That's a great place to end it. That's a really great place to end our talk about Sidney Lumet. So, Alan, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome.
Such a huge honor. I said to you off air.
Well, there's one thing we both have to do.
Yes?
We've got to go to the window, open the window, and say, we're not going to take it no more.
Mad as hell. I said,
that scene will live forever.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, like I said, your Trailers from Hell are some of my favorites because they're like little film schools.
Yeah.
And I love all the guys on there, but they are – we've had Larry Karczewski on the show, and I love his stuff.
I love Larry, like, yeah.
I love Larry.
Him up. Like, I said, Larry, you're so prepped. He goes, well, I happen to know a lot about him.
Yeah, I mean, I said, I absolutely love watching your Trailers from Hell. So thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate
Pleasure.
It.
Pleasure. All right. Nice talking to a film lover.
Okay. Thank you. Great talking to you. Thank you, Alan.
Bye.
So that's going to do it for this episode of Fade Out. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening. Of course, you can find back episodes of this show on fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Fade Out Pod. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So if you want to support this show, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. So that is going to do it. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
It starts when I either have read a script that's been sent to me, and I just react completely instinctively. I'm not analyzing it. I have no theme. I have no idea of the kind of picture I want to do. I'm open, and a very good audience. And what to me is interesting is that almost every time I've accepted a script, it's been on the first reading. If I've had to read it more than once, chances are I've said no. And
if it doesn't grab you at first reading, then you pass.
Well, you know, there are obviously deficiencies in this. I've done some very bad movies, but I've also done some very good ones.